thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. Hey everyone, just a quick note before we begin this week's show. The episode you're about to hear first aired on December 2nd, 2019, as part of that year's Bomber Month. And we just learned today, October 2nd, 2021, that our guest on this episode, Mr. Crawford Hicks, has passed away at the tender age of 100. Naturally, our condolences go out to the Hicks family and all those who knew and loved him. And in a moment, you'll hear our usual enthusiastic tone on the show, but we are, of course, saddened by his loss. Rest in peace, sir.
Forget Shark Week. Here on the Fighter Pilot Podcast, it's Bomber Month. Every Monday from December 2nd to the 23rd, we'll feature a different American bomber. From the venerable World War II era Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress to the cutting edge Northrop Grumman B-2 Spirit. Never mind the announcements. Listener questions can wait. Let's get straight to the bombers with your host, retired U.S. Navy fighter pilot Vincent Aiello.
Today, the Fighter Pilot Podcast is at the Museum of Aviation at Robins Air Force Base in Warner Robins, Georgia. And I am joined by Mr. Mike Rowland. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on the show. You're going to help us talk about the B-17 Flying Fortress, and we just happen to be sitting next to one.
It is an exciting airplane to see up close, mm-hmm. the way we have here. Well, we're very fortunate to have the airplane.
Cool. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about that, and then I understand you have someone else we should talk to. But first, let's get to know you very quickly. Where are you from, and what have you done, and what are you doing?
So you may enjoy this part. I am a Navy brat.
Oh, all right.
My dad served in the Navy a career. I started out in diesel submarines as an electrician's mate.
Okay.
Eventually went to school, got a degree, came back as an officer.
Great.
Served in submarines, then he went into the logistics, the supply corps, mm-hmm. logistics side. I went into the Air Force. I served on active duty for 6 years. Enjoyed it, learned a lot, but felt like maybe there was something else I wanted to do. So I got into museum work, went to the University of Florida where I got a degree in museum studies. Mm. Came to the Museum of Aviation as an intern.
Okay.
Went back to the University of Florida thinking I'd never see the place. Was hired. On around the time I graduated, and I've been here for 15 years.
And you are currently the curator of this museum.
Yes.
Wow. And this is an impressive facility. What can you tell us about the Museum of Aviation here?
The Museum of Aviation is the second largest museum in the United States Air Force, and it opened in 1984, so this is our 35th anniversary year.
Excellent.
We're very excited about that.
Yeah.
We have 4 exhibit buildings. And about 90 airplanes, well over half are inside.
Okay.
And really kind of focused on World War II to the present. So it's just a neat place. Free to the public. We hope that people will come and visit.
Well, if they are in Central Georgia, they absolutely should, because just getting in the door to meet you today, I saw a B-1, an F-15, a B-52, an A-10, a C-130, a C, what was that, 124, I think you've got outside.
124, yes.
And then I walk into this amazing hangar, and the first thing I see is a B-29. You've got another hangar with fighters. And right now, we're sitting next to the subject of today's episode, and that's a B-17. And what can you tell us about this particular aircraft?
Well, the B-17 is one of those just really famous, an iconic airplane.
Absolutely.
So people, when they think of a World War II strategic bomber, they almost certainly think of the B-17, probably even more than the B-29. And I think that's because the B-17 has been in so many movies.
Right.
It just kind of stays there in the conscience. I think, too, that one of the great things about the B-17 is this really dramatic human story that began with, you know, in the factory. The airplane was mass-produced, but it was put together by hand. Mm-hmm. You had Rosie the Riveter, but you had thousands of other people working together on it. And so people had their hands all over this airplane in the factory. Uh-huh. It gets out to the field. The mechanics have their hands all over this airplane. And then a typical 10-man crew is flying it in combat. And you have literally humanity from one end of the airplane to the other.
So it's so much more than just the metal and the rubber and all the different parts that make up an inanimate object like an airplane. It's the fingerprints, if you will, the stories. And this particular one is undergoing a renovation. And for the listeners, if you hear children's voices, that's because we're inside the museum and they are walking by, enjoying all the different displays. And there are people inside this particular aircraft. What can you tell us about this one?
So this one was built very late in World War II and was not flown in combat.
Okay.
It went into storage very soon after it was produced, waited around. Eventually, though, this particular airplane was modified as a drone control airplane and was used to control other B-17s that were used on test missions, most famously for this particular airplane at the museum for some of the atomic bomb testing out in the Pacific. So this airplane was controlling other B-17s that were flown into the cloud after an atomic test.
So even way back then, drone control was, I mean, we all think of it as sort of modern technology, but they were doing it 60 years ago. Okay. All right. So this being the Fighter Pilot Podcast and the aircraft series, Mike, we're talking about the B-17. We know that this was a strategic bomber, basically, for World War II and did it quite well. And there was a handful of variants, right? So we had some early kind of, not pre-production, but some prototype variants. What can you tell us about the ones that were operational? I think, beginning with the E model?
That sounds right.
Okay. So the E, F, and G, right?
Right. So the very earliest models had some machine guns, and that's where it picked up the name Flying Fortress.
Because it looks like a fortress.
But what we're used to is like the G model that we have here with, you know, guns sticking out of the nose, the top and lower turrets, the tail, the waist gun positions. But the early B-17s didn't have as many guns.
Oh, wow.
And so combat experience showed that they had to add more weaponry.
Okay.
So that's, you know, it became more of a flying fortress over the course of time. The G model that we have at the museum was the most produced version, kind of the definitive model of the B-17. A good balance of range and payload capacity and so on. A good flying airplane as far as that goes.
Sure. And do you recall, as far as ordnance goes, I mean, so it's 50 caliber guns. I want to say, did they end up with about 13 different guns? Maybe it's less, because I know the crew is about 10, but at any rate, bristling with guns, I think we can safely say. What about ordnance otherwise on the aircraft? I mean, it's a bomber, so just regular type bombs or?
Typically, you know, B-17s flew in combat in the Pacific in the early part of the war, but they just didn't have the range over the long distances. So the B-17 in the Pacific was quickly replaced by the B-24 Liberator. In Europe, though, generally the B-17 was flying with just a general-purpose bomb, a 500-pounder, a 1,000-pounder. Sometimes they'd carry a little bit more. It would a heavier bomb, depending on the target, if they were going to hit, you know, U-boat pens, for instance.
Right.
But generally, it's going to be a 500 to a 1,000-pound general-purpose bomb.
And up to, I believe, if I read correctly, about 4,000 pounds capacity?
About 4,000 pounds.
Which is interesting, because it's actually arguably not that much, but this is also a 70, 80-year-old design, right?
So that's one of the things that really strikes me about an airplane like this. It is big. You walk around it. It's really impressive, but it's got a really small bomb bay for such a big airplane. Right. Really, actually, a pretty small bomb load for such a big airplane.
Okay. And, of course, it is made famous by, as you said, several places, but most notably probably is the movie Memphis Belle. It was showcased in that. And that aircraft still exists, right?
That airplane is a magnificent icon for the United States, and it is on display at the National Museum of the United States Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base outside of Dayton, Ohio.
Okay.
It's on display. It is really impressive.
Awesome.
Highly recommend a visit there.
Well, it's been several years. I went there last as a Top Gun instructor, so it's been almost 20 years, gosh.
And you need to go back.
I need to go back. And same thing for the Naval Museum in Pensacola, because it's changed a lot as well. But these museums, and especially this one, Mike, are just amazing because it's a way to preserve and promote the history for the next generation, right?
Right. And, you know, people can say, well, you know, I can just take in a B-17 virtually on my computer, or I can look at pictures or watch a movie. But there's nothing quite like being able to come up and see for yourself its size, its scale, and you can start imagining, you know, the people and their experiences with it.
Right. And something like over 12,000 were made, but there's not that many left.
There really aren't. You know, I don't know what the numbers are, but many were destroyed in combat or training or whatever, and then were quickly brought out of frontline service because there were better airplanes by the end of the war or the post-war years.
Right.
You know, some of them hung around for a long time just as almost kind of, I don't know, hack airplanes. Our B-17 was one of the last in service, and it was retired to Bunker Hill Air Force Base in North Central Indiana.
Okay.
It went on display there in 1961 and was outside for 54 years before we were able to recover it and bring it here for restoration.
Wow. And it's not like we're tucked away in a part of the hangar where no one can see. I mean, this renovation, refurbishment, whatever we should call it, is happening right in front of your patrons' eyes, right?
Right. It's really fun. Part of it is the size of the airplane. We had to get it into a place where we could work on it. But yes, visitors can come up and they can see the work that's going on.
Very cool. And I understand there is a local here in this area who flew these in the war. Is that right?
Yes. Crawford Hicks is a delightful fellow, and I'm glad you get to meet him and talk with him. He flew B-17s, and he'll tell you some great stories.
Excellent. Well, why don't we go track him down? I appreciate you giving us an overview of the aircraft, and we'll see what Mr. Hicks has to say about his time flying this in World War II.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Today, the Fighter Pilot Podcast is at the Museum of Aviation at Robins Air Force Base in central Georgia, and we are joined by a young man by the name of Mr. Crawford Hicks. How are you today, sir?
Fine, thank you, sir.
Great. Well, thank you for taking the time to allow us to meet, and we will talk about you and one of the aircraft here in this museum that you flew, and that is the B-17 Flying Fortress. But can you tell us a little bit about you first? So let's just prime the pump. You said earlier you were born in 1921.
Correct.
And are you from Kentucky?
From outside of Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay.
Yes.
And then you served in the U.S. Army Air Corps, and then it turned into the Air Force for over 20 years and retired as a lieutenant colonel.
And I was one of the Brown Shoe Army.
Okay. And now here you are in central Georgia. But tell us a little bit about your youth as far as what interested you in flying and then what you did in your military career.
Okay. Born in 1921, when I was about 5 or 6, 7 years old, there was a lot of news about the German and the English and the American fighter pilots in World War I. And of course, I was interested in that, and I used to build model airplanes. And so anyway, I started reading when I was about 6 years old, and I read the newspaper, everything they said to say. So I built model airplanes and wanted to fly all my life. But I was raised on the farm, and I loved to read, which I did. And I was the youngest of 4. My mother and brother were the farmers. I hated farm work and went to school. And I loved to read, so that helped me tremendously.
Okay.
And my father had been a school teacher, and he was always on my case about using correct grammar. Lindbergh was my idol.
Charles Lindbergh.
Okay. And I remember, I could think it was 1926. I'm not sure about that. But it's something like that when he flew across the ocean.
Okay.
And I read his story 3 or 4 or 5 times, and I read everything about him and how wonderful. I could just imagine myself. And also, they had mail carriers. They were first starting with air mail delivery at that point in time. And I remember reading about the mail carriers, how they'd be in the soup and they couldn't know where to go and things of this sort. So
sure.
It was very, this is very fascinating to me. School was fun to me.
All right.
So anyway, went to high school and I did pretty well in high school because I was comfortable with what I was learning to do.
Okay.
And graduated in 1939 and outside of Louisville. I went to, started to college, University of Louisville, at that fall. I didn't have anything, but I played football in high school, not very well, but I played. And so they gave me a $10 scholarship to play football and play football. Well, I never played in a single game, and I didn't study, didn't know how to study, didn't want to study. I flunked out after my first semester.
Oh, no.
I didn't go back.
Okay.
They didn't kick me out. I just didn't go back. Anyway, so I didn't have any money, and I wanted money. So finally, I got a job in a bank, and a very low-paying job. I think I got $50 a month for 6 days a week.
Wow.
But I was able to drive my Model A forward. And then the war came along.
Right.
And I, of course, one, I knew I was going to have to go.
Sure,
I was 20 years old and had to go. So I quit my job immediately and went home. I was out in Oklahoma. And my mother would not sign my papers to fly because it was too dangerous. So I waited until I was 21, which was in February. And I went down to the people and signed up to fly. I was accepted as a aviation cadet.
Okay.
Or no, I was accepted. Of course, I applied for aviation. July of 42, I started active duty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was an interesting thing in itself. Something like 60 of us went to active duty and then did what they had to do and get our shots and get our uniforms and get oriented into the military life. And then we went to examinations for flying.
Okay.
And I think there were 60 of us took the exam this first time. And please, I want you to know that, to keep this in context, because none of them so smart, but because people were not so smart, maybe. 60 of us took the exam, and only 9 of us passed the first aptitude exam. Only 9 of us. That's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to and had a physical exam, and only 6 of us passed that. So they really washed a lot of people out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I did pass the 6. I was just thrilled to go.
Sure.
I was engaged at the time, and my sister and my fiance took me to the airport to go to active duty. They were crying.
Of course.
I couldn't understand why. I was just jumping up and down, ready to go, because I wanted to fly an airplane. Anyway, so went to the not basic training, but the preliminary down in Montgomery, Alabama.
Okay.
And went to cadets there. They had 2 months of West Point type training.
All right.
We had to, as their first month, we were the plebes, and we had to stand at attention anytime we talked to somebody, and we'd walk along the side of the walk. We couldn't walk in the middle of the walk, and our barracks were inspected every day. Our beds we had to have our beds tightened and everything like that. I loved every bit of it. Calisthenics, and I hated it, but it made me, well, I did well.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I got through that already. And then started flying school down in Albany, Georgia. The washout rate had decreased after going through the basic training, to the pre-basic training.
Mm-hmm.
So went to Dar Aerotech, learned to fly in a Stearman, had, I think it was 30 hours.
Okay. So a biplane tail dragger.
The first, in order to solo, you had to do some landings under supervision. So we had to do 3 landings on 3 days to see that we could land by ourselves. The third landing of the first day, I ground looped with a little bit of grass stain on the wingtip. Didn't hurt it, but it's a little bit. I was able to recover well. And on the third day, I did the same thing with the other wingtip, but they let me pass anyway. So I went through there, then went to, that was at a DAR down in Albany, Georgia. And went to Greenville, Mississippi to fly the BT-13. It had twice the horsepower that the Stearman had, and we could do a lot of things. We could do snap rolls and all the and other things of that sort, and spins, and enjoy them, and we did. Did a lot of cross-country and a lot of radio work. And then they divided us, who wants to go to single-engine, who wants to go to multi-engine. I wanted to go to multi-engine, so I did and went to Vincennes, Indiana. I flew the AT-10, and I think two engines together equaled the BT-13's one engine. This kind of power it had, not much. But got through there all right, was happy, and I loved it. And so then I got my wings and got my commission.
What year was this now?
1943.
Oh.
I was in class 43D. So I got from there and went home, had a 30-day vacation on leave, then went to Columbus, Ohio, and started to learn how to fly B-17.
Okay.
Remember walking out on the tarmac one day and I saw it, and I thought, I'll never be able to fly that thing. 103-foot wingspan, and here I'd been used to a Stearman. And so you can imagine what the transition was. Had a wonderful teacher, and he put me in the left seat, which I was going to fly, and made me fly left-handed, which I had to learn to do.
Left-handed, okay.
He would not let me use the trim tabs to do anything in landing or anything, because I had to horse it around with my hand. I had calluses on my left hand from doing it, but I loved it.
Uh-huh.
So I learned how to fly the 17 and thoroughly enjoyed it. Then went from there to Pyote, Texas. This is what I'm trying to remember. Pyote, Texas.
Okay, Pyote.
It's about 200 miles east of El Paso, right smack in the middle of the desert.
Mm.
And they called it the Rattlesnake Bomber Base because they had to use bulldozers to clean off the rattlesnakes before they could build a base on there.
Oh, gosh.
That's how bad it was, out in a desolate area.
Right.
And one night, remember, this is an aside a little bit, but one night I remember taking off and it was dark, no sun, no cloud, no moon. No moon. Took off, and I went on instruments immediately, because I could see nothing but stars and stars. And what it was, I was seeing all the oil flares in the ground,
uh-huh,
which looked like stars, and you couldn't differentiate the stars from the oil ground. So I had to go on instruments immediately when it took off.
All right.
But we did that. Learned to fly a lot of formation. I flew a lot of B-17 formation. And I loved it, because, you know, it would do anything you wanted it to do. It's very easy and good to fly.
Right.
Very
well, good. That's what we're going to talk about here in a second.
Okay.
So,
it was very good and stable, and, it just responded to what you told it to do.
Okay.
And then went to, still in Texas, up in the topper part of the Panhandle as my second phase. And there I picked up my crew, co-pilot, bombardier and navigator, and then we had six enlisted men. But these guys were with us all the rest of the time.
Okay.
I had been graduated from flying school about 6 months at that point in time, maybe seven. But I was designated first pilot, and my co-pilot had, I think, 2 months he had been graduated. So he was quite new. I had to teach him whatever I knew. So anyway, we had a good combination. Learned formation flying, did a lot of that. Learned bombing. Mm-hmm. We did practice bombing a whole lot. They would establish three spots on the ground, and they put a little building in the middle of them, or a little signature place for them, with lights and so forth, and formed a triangle. So we would take off at nighttime, and we always wore oxygen all the time, took off at nighttime and flew a triangular plan and dropped bombs on those three points.
Hmm.
And they were 20,000 feet. So that was pretty good. And my bombardier turned out to be a whale of a good one, because there was a circle of about 50 feet around each one of these markers down on the ground.
Uh-huh.
If you got within that circle, you were doing darn well. But he hit the shack in the middle of the circle, and he dropped bombs.
Very good.
So that was it. Good.
Now let me interrupt. What were you dropping? Were they live bombs or just cement?
No, cement. Yeah,
practice bombs.
Maybe they had an explosive to show where they hit.
Smoke charge.
Something, something like that. And they were light ones. They were 200 pounds. No, wouldn't be that much, would it? I don't know how much they weighed.
Yeah, I don't know.
It was just light enough to be a bomb.
Right, and the right ballistics.
Yeah, that's right.
And so you could practice the right techniques for what you would use coming up here.
We'd bomb it. It was a crackerjack. He really could do it. And
All right.
We got along well as a team. Finished there and went to Kearney, Nebraska.
All right.
This was in early 1943. We got there and they said, Hicks, here it is, sign for this brand new B-17. So I had to sign for one. It had 6 hours on there for something like that.
Like a new car.
Yeah, it was. It was. You could smell new. Mm. So we got in it, and so we had to go up and see what it's like, you know. And I remember our top altitude was about 30,000 feet.
Okay.
But I wanted to see how much higher it'd go.
Uh-oh.
So I got up to be about 34,000 feet and started getting a little bit mushy. Mm. Then I came back down again.
And you said earlier you would wear supplemental oxygen, the whole crew would?
Oh, yeah, the whole crew, yes.
So, because it was obviously open windows for the gunners.
And then the oxygen system. I don't even think they had an oxygen system other than through the mask.
Okay.
I don't believe they did.
And so you'd put that on, what, at 10,000 feet?
No later than that.
Okay.
When you did night missions, we put it on the ground.
Oh.
So because you didn't want you fumbling around in the dark.
Okay.
In doing the bombing, you'd fly in around the triangle, you know, drop bombs on each of those markers on the ground. And I was on the way home, and I was sitting back and enjoying. We had finished our job, and so let's go home now. And I saw a couple of lights up ahead of me. So all of a sudden, then my crew chief hit me on the shoulder, look up there, and I saw it more clearly. And I kicked the hard rudder and pushed the nose down, and two fighters split. Dismissing me.
Gosh.
Yeah. Now,
you weren't talking to them, obviously, or anyone was controlling you. It was just seeing a void?
Yeah, just seeing. Yeah, that's right. Now, the things I'm talking about are dangerous.
Mm.
But you know what? I didn't feel it. I didn't feel a danger. I felt such a great deal of self-confidence in the airplane. And, of course, they trained me well. Now, that was a big thing about it. I know as looking back on it, they trained me over and over. And, well, all of us, they trained us all well. So these things were not hair-raising. They happened, but...
You were, like so many young men, impervious. You know, it would happen
exactly
to someone else, right?
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Because, hey, we got through that all right. What's going on next? I used to think we were through a lot of formation.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, I would try to get my wingtip at least, even with my lead airplane wing, or maybe inside a little bit, because I just like to get fly close and enjoy.
Sure.
You know, and I enjoyed flying formation just tremendously.
So the airplane that was assigned to you that had 6 hours, what model of a B-17 was that? Because I understand you had A through D were the early ones, and then you had the E, F, and G?
I think it was a D, R, and E. I forget. I think it was an E. Because when I finally went overseas, it was in the end of March of 1943. Yeah, I think that's when it was, March of 1943. I flew to Labrador, to Maine, landed.
Topped off.
Yeah.
Yep.
Then flew up to Goose Bay, Labrador.
Okay.
And I was smoking cigarettes. And there's also, I had a lot of sinus problems. And I went in at 30,000 because it was so socked in all the way down. And got to Goose Bay and I couldn't even land because of the bad weather.
Oh, gosh.
So then I had to come back to the States. My nose wouldn't clear up during the whole time. And when I landed, so that my air pressure, which was less in my head than it was on the outside, was pushing all this bad stuff up to my septum and in my head.
Yuck.
And my head felt like knives going into it when I landed. Anyway,
all right.
And the co-pilot helped me land on that one. We landed at Goose Bay. The snow on either side of the runway was higher than the tail of the 17. At 17 feet, you know. We made the smoothest landing we ever made. You couldn't even feel it. Wow. It was that good.
So the B-17s that left the United States and went to the European theater were all flown over. They weren't put on ships?
I have to say that's true, yes. There were several of us in this gaggle, if you will,
sure.
at that
Making
point.
Your way over.
All right. So I would think, yes, we there were no airplanes carried over. They flew over.
Okay. Can we talk just briefly about the B-17 as far as flying it goes? Was it a joy to fly or was it difficult? How did you find the actual stick and rudder of landings? And, you know, obviously when you were employing weapons later, as we'll get to in your story, you're mostly straight and level. But what about flying the B-17? What was that like?
I'm trying to be as honest with you and me both as I can. Mm-hmm. I was apprehensive when I first got into it. It was so big. I learned how to cope with that. Mm-hmm. I felt more I got into it. I'll try to get to answer your question in just a minute. I enjoyed it more. I'd go out and on the solo meaning I was the only pilot and the co-pilot and I, but we had a crew, but no instructors meant what that meant.
Okay.
I'd go out and fight formation inside the wing and these all those other things. And to answer your question, I'm going around circles. Excuse me.
But that's all right.
To answer your question, it was a joy to fly. And I drove it all the time. I didn't use the automatic pilot very much once in a while, yes. But it was a joy to fly. Responded so nicely to what you had.
Right. And was it easy to control? Were there pulleys or what kind of,
we had
a lot of work?
We had a dual system, both electronic and physical. The 24s had a hydraulic system. Ours was electric.
The B-24s?
The B-24s were hydraulic. They had hydraulics, you know, to the elevator and the elevators and they were on and so forth. So ours were electric and physical.
Wow.
And this was a savior, too, by the way. Mm. So it was quite easy to do. Quite good. And it responded nicely. You could drive by feel a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
A very easy airplane to fly, a very easy one to land. Uh-huh. Of course, you can't. The only problem you had with landing, these late fighter jocks come in and they have tricycle gears, so they come in and they see a drift and on the runway, they correct it and as they're coming in, and then the last minute they see they kick rudder and go come in straight. We came in like that, but when we had to fly in to do 3-3-point landings.
Because it was a tail dragger, the B-17, right?
That's right. So it was a little more difficult, but you could do it. But that was only, I didn't have any problem with it. I had to really be on my toes when I did that. But you bring it in and you cut it back and you let it fall and you let it fall and you see where it is. And all of a sudden you kick it straight and pull the cubs and the throttle back and you hit the ground. The B-17 had the most beautiful sound to it when it hit the ground. The brakes squeaked. They squeaked, and you could always hear B-17 coming in.
Yeah.
Just squeaked so loud.
All right.
Loved the airplane. Loved it.
And did you find it to be very reliable? Obviously, with the four engines, you have some redundancy.
Yes. Yes. I never had an engine to go out on me.
Really?
In the whole time I flew it. And when we got to combat, we flew an airplane that wasn't in good shape, and I had trouble with the turbochargers. And so I jockeyed the throttle the whole mission. We were all over the airplane because of the runway. The props would run away and kinds of things like this. Well, we did the mission and got back. I don't know how pertinent that is, but it's very easy to handle.
Okay. Let's talk about the crew again. You said it was a crew of roughly
10 total.
Okay. And so you had two pilots and then a navigator and a bombardier.
Correct.
Now, were they all officers?
Yes, four officers.
And then the six remaining were the various gunners.
Geneva Convention, and I'm answering your question, but I had to go around. The Geneva Convention called for treatment of prisoners of war. So in all the nations that had joined the Geneva Convention agreed that POWs would be handled humanely. But also, their humaneness was done in tiers, the highest tier meaning no bad treatment. Then on down, you didn't get as much food and not as good quarters. And on down, no lower, you got a little food and you had to work hard and things like that. Mm-hmm. So we had about three levels, the Geneva Convention.
In your airplane?
No, the Geneva Convention. Call for that. So all of our enlisted guys, they were sergeants or staff sergeants.
Okay.
Buck sergeants or task sergeant seven, mm-hmm. because, of course, they were technical, but also because of the convention, they would be treated more kindly when they if they got out.
So you had a mix of the officer and the enlisted?
Oh, yeah. The senior was the flight engineer who stood right behind me, and he manned the top two guns. Like, he's the one who hit me on the shoulder when I saw these airplanes coming in.
Right.
You know, helped me to remember. So he helped me fly the airplane.
Okay. How about between the pilot and the co-pilot? What were the shared responsibilities? Was it always that one flew and the other did something else, or would you trade back and forth, or?
A lot of that was personality, I think. A lot of that was determined by personality.
Okay.
Gene Bianco, he was Italian-born and from Syracuse, New York. His job was to watch the engine and gas and the feed and food mixture and watch that kind of thing. And also when he got in combat, to keep an eye for being an observer.
Sure.
It was his primary job. I flew most of the time, actually handled the airplane most of the time. I'd say 60, 75% of the time.
You were flying?
I flew it. Okay. I drove it, yeah.
Okay.
As he drove it. I was on the controls, controlling sure. it, yeah. But now I watched the pitch control, watch that carefully. And incidentally, if you did not have the pitch done properly, incidentally, the pitch is the amount of bite that the propeller takes of the air. It's like a screw.
Mm-hmm.
And so you change, you can control the pitch. If you have a high pitch, like a not very much, not much of a bite, or low pitch. If you had a low pitch, you had a lot of power, but no speed, not to speak of.
Okay.
So we would take off. We wouldn't have a lot of speed, so we put our pitch into a lower, taking a more bite.
Okay.
Taking more bite, but by doing so, it also put a greater strain on the engines.
Sure.
To take that larger bite.
Mm-hmm.
So as the minute our wheels left the ground, we'd pull the engine back and adjust the prop pitch control, and then we go to flying at flying level and so forth.
Sure.
My job was to handle the throttles. And the prop pitch. Now, Gene, the co-pilot's job was to watch the fuel mixture.
Mm-hmm.
We had gasoline. We had a handle for each one of the engines. And you would adjust the gasoline and air that the engines got. You wanted to have enough, because if you didn't, they wouldn't work well or overheat. But you had too much, they wouldn't work well either. So he had to watch that all the time.
Okay.
Now, all three of them, both he and I and the engineer, kept our eyes on the compass, because that was such a critical thing.
Hmm.
Then the radio operator sat in back of the bomb bay. The bomb bay consisted of two racks, mm-hmm. and you could have 500-pound bombs, and each one of them had two racks. In order to get from the front pilot's area to the back, you had to walk so on this very narrow catwalk between the bomb range, bomb racks.
Huh.
And incidentally, the only toilet we had was called a pitot tube. Well, it was a tube with a funnel on the end. And in order to go to the bathroom, we had to go out back there in the bomb bay and stand in that passageway. And now,
because you had very long flights, right?
The B-17 we did. Yes,
could
we did,
fly, what, up to 10 hours?
Well, I think my longest was about 8.5.
Wow.
But you have to go sometimes.
Sure.
I think I used it one time because I was made careful that I was going to not have to go. Because it was a pain. Okay. When we were flying altitude, which we did all the time, we had our regular trousers on like we have, our flying suit. Then we had electric suit over that.
Sure.
Now, in order to use the toilet, you had to go through that electric suit, then through the regular travel suit you have, then you throw your underwear and get to yourself so you can pee. It's a long, hard...
that's a process.
It was. All and right. then, because of the altitude, you really were not very manly. Oh, I don't know whether you...
In other words, the blood was more needed elsewhere?
Well, yes, and you had to find your penis because it was so cold, and you didn't find it all the time, and you did, so you peed in your pants.
Which is great at first because it's warm, but then it's no good after that, yes.
That's right. But no, I'm trying not to be a bogger.
This is what we like on the show. This is the reality of what you had to deal with. So in other words, you practiced, if I may, tactical dehydration. You tried not to drink too much water because then you'd have to go to the bathroom.
Absolutely.
Too much, right? I think I interrupted your story from a long time before, but you obviously finally made your way over to England in 1943.
Well, let me tell you that the jobs of the people.
I was a
radio operator, very good. He didn't see anything because he was in his little cabin, did not have the turret on top like some of the airplanes did.
Okay.
He did not. He sat there and he had these transformers, I'll call them that, on the floor of the airplane. There's about 4 or 5 inches high above the floor, and he would rest his foot on them when he was working. He had a long antenna, which he could let out at an in-flight, and that would give us distance.
Ah.
And then he'd reach it back in when we got ready to land. But I'm jumping around a little bit, but we got a hold in the airplane every mission I was on. I was on 10 missions.
A hold in the airplane?
A hold from flak or from fighters or something.
Sure.
Every time. And one day, a piece of flak came in through the bottom and hit this transformer that was on his foot and kicked his foot up in the air.
And, no kidding.
And he called me on the phone. He said, "Hey, Skipper, they're getting a little bit better down there."
Didn't hurt his foot. It just lifted it up a bit. Oh, heavens. Well, we're going to get to a story you have here in a moment about they got a little better yet after that, right? So,
oh, yes. Okay. Well, we had a hole every time we went out, every time.
That's amazing.
Every mission. Okay. That was his job to do the radio and help us with our direction and so forth. Okay. The waist gunners just had to see to us that things were in good shape back there. We had two waist gunners, two windows on each side, and those guys would have to stand in those windows with their single 50 caliber machine guns and fly to and shoot from the side. Now, I'm digressing. Imagine yourself, you have a squirt gun, and you see something out there that you want to hit. You're going this way. That other guy's going this way, or maybe he's going this way, maybe. But you had to shoot this gun so to make that stream go around in a circle and hits this other guy when he's passed by. You with me?
Because of the airstreams and
and the different speeds and everything like that. How they ever hit anybody, I do not know.
Well, did they have special airplanes that in training they could fly up and let them shoot?
We had that a little bit, yes, a little bit.
And did it give a light if they hit it, or I forget how they did it?
I don't know really how they scored. I really don't know. Don't remember that. I don't think we had a light as such.
No? Okay. I might be confusing that with a different. So it was probably on-the-job training, and if you had instant feedback, then you could adjust from there, right?
Yeah, it would be something like that.
And they would share stories with each other on best practices, I'm sure.
Okay. Especially with the shack that we talked about earlier.
Right.
You know, we talked about that. But their job in the wind, in the back by the rear part of the airplane, was to shoot airplanes that were coming in from the side.
Right.
Because they didn't have much area to cover.
Mm-hmm.
They could only go so high and so low and so much forward and so far back. They were limited because they had the wings and the tail and everything else. So,
was it up to them to not shoot the wing off, or was there a mechanical stop on the machine gun?
Yeah, they had machine guns mounted near the window, so they may have had mechanical stop.
That would seem the most prudent.
May have.
Okay.
It makes sense, yes. But it'd be impossible to hit an airplane. Airplanes were doing 200 miles an hour, we'll say.
Uh-huh.
Our airspeed, ground speed, was 150 miles an hour. Top speed.
Top speed?
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy.
I mean, I say top.
If
you flew higher than that, you would damage the engines.
Okay.
So we flew all our missions at 150 miles an hour.
That's standing still, relatively.
Yes, it is. Even though we flew, I think our lowest mission was 27,000, and we flew from 31 to 29,000 feet on our bomb run.
Okay.
That's 5 miles up.
And that's hard to be accurate, but you had a good bombardier, you said.
Well, Norden bomb sight.
Mm.
I ran it one time to see how it worked. The Norden bomb site was a top secret or secret matter at that point in time, but it enabled, and also the airplane had automatic pilot on it, so the pilot could put it on cruise control, if you will,
right,
and then it'd fly by itself. But the bombardier had a control for that on that cruise control.
So he could put the airplane where he needed.
That's right. He could now he could adjust the elevation up or down a little bit and side to side, left to right.
Sure.
He could adjust that to make his bomb site be compatible with that Norden bomb site. Now, because it was top secret.
At the time.
If we flew in 18 ship formations, 6 airplanes in the first squadron, 6 airplanes in the second squadron, which was up, and flew off the first squadron's wing, 6 in the lower squadron, and they flew off the airplane's wing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we flew 18 airplanes and would drop our bombs at the same time.
Now, would all of them do their own triangulation or bomb calculations, or would they just watch for one to drop and then they'd all drop?
Good point. Because of the secrecy of the bomb site, we were told that the only airplanes that had the bomb site in them were the lead and second lead.
Okay. Of all 18 or of each
all
element?
All 18. Of the first 18 airplanes, only 2 of them had the bomb site.
Okay.
The first airplane to say the lead and the number 2, that squadron. So we all dropped bombs on them. Or they gave the signal, or they showed, we opened their bomb bay doors, we did.
Right.
And it was fully predetermined what was going to happen. I don't know what kind of communication existed when they dropped. They may have done give us a radio number, I don't know. But the bombardier's job was to watch that lead airplane, and when they dropped, he dropped.
Okay.
Now, we didn't drop like all the big to one time. We had what they call an intervalometer on the bomb site.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't because he didn't have bomb sites. The lead did. If we wanted to do a lot of widespread bombing, we would let them drop in intervals, bang, 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 bang. Or if we had we could all drop at the same time, all depending on the target.
Sure, if you wanted to concentrate the impact or spread it out.
Yeah, we hit Berlin 4 times, and we had it intervalometer, because we just wanted to do as much damage as we could. Then let's go back to the tail gunner now. And he was way back in the very end, and he was comfortable. He had good quarters. See, the guys in the wings had to stand all the time to work.
Right.
Everybody else sat.
Okay.
And then the tail gunner, I think he lay there, I'm not sure, but he had 2 guns, and he can use them at his, he had a pretty wide spectrum,
because
sort of like a cone that he had.
Okay. And he had twin guns, I think, right?
Twin guns back there,
single
guns in the side, engineer had double guns.
On the top.
I think in the later airplanes, we had 2 guns in the 10. Two in the ball turret, too.
Underneath, yep.
Yeah. He was my number one concern in combat, because I can just see him being in that ball, and we got hit, and we're falling, and jumping out in the parachute, and he's still there. It was almost frightening to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember when we got hit from the fighter, I said, "Get Vasilik out of that ball." I remember now jumping on the intercom, and then there's the two side gunners would help him get out of the ball.
Did he get in there from the beginning of the flight or go down prior to expected combat kind of thing?
No, he would get into the ball, after we had taken off, and then we started getting to our positions.
Right, okay.
Yeah, because he was not totally comfortable under there. He had to scrunch up,
Right.
And after, when we got back, that's when we left enemy territory, he'd get out.
Okay. Now, let's talk about, because you alluded to it now, but you did so many missions over Germany
right.
in 1944.
44, correct.
Okay. And let's talk about some of those missions. You said you attacked Berlin. Any other noteworthy attacks prior to, there was one where you had a takeoff but no landing, correct?
Oh, yeah. And I think that was Aschersleben. And I think it was a gun manufacturer or mechanical. Now, remember who we were. We were not the guys. We were, they don't do as I say, do as I do. We were guys in the back, and we just did what we were told.
Okay.
Now, I'm not being nasty in saying that, but mm-hmm. our upper echelon didn't want us to know too much.
Oh.
We didn't need it and wouldn't do any good.
In other words, just fly in formation and drop when the guy drops?
Yeah, fly and follow me and do what I do.
Okay.
And we understood that. It was not a problem, but they are the ones who had the intelligence information.
Okay.
And also the navigators, and my navigator was very good, and he was given some intelligence information, more than I had.
Really?
More than I have. And going forward, we got captured and went to this interrogation center. They had spies in England, so they knew the airplanes, knew when they took off, and they knew all these kinds of things. And I'm doing around circles, but I need to tell a little story in order to get to the story.
Did you know an F-35 fighter jet is made up of approximately 50,000 fasteners? High-strength nuts, bolts, washers, rivets, and other aviation-grade fasteners are also used on spacecraft, race cars, and even do-it-yourself projects by hobbyists. If your next project at work or at home calls for mil-spec aerospace hardware, look to D&L Components Incorporated. D&L Components consults space manufacturers, engineering companies, and high-tech startups on hardware availability, application, and alternatives that may lower cost or be more readily available without compromising quality. D&L Components sources alloy steel, A286, titanium, Inco 718, and other Krez materials for bolts, washers, nuts, rivets, Hilox, hydraulic fittings, and more, or they can custom machine when you submit your prints and specs. Go to dnlcomponents.com to learn more and to schedule a consultation with Donnie or Larry. That's dnlcomponents.com.
We would be briefed to fly at a particular altitude. We knew our positions in the formation, but we were able to fly and bomb at a particular altitude. We were told this in our briefing. And this time we were briefed at a particular level, may have been 27 or 28,000 feet, I don't know. But at the runway, takeoff runway, they had a big blackboard set up and said Angel Plus 2, which told us that we were flying at our prescribed altitude plus 2,000 feet. That was our last mission, since they hit Oschersleben. And apparently they did that because of gunnery range and things of this sort.
Okay.
So that's what we did. But Oschersleben is the one where we hit the target, okay, and we left and did our diving turn to the left or right. Beautiful to see 18 airplanes all diving at the same time and turning out. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
We went to start on our way home, and the engineer, I forget who it was, said, notice we had an airplane coming toward us. It was the ME-109, and we all could see it pretty much the same time. You could see the guns, the shells coming out of the nose. Messerschmitt 109 had a gun which fired through the propeller hub, meaning that the pilot could aim his airplane like a rifle and make the shell go where he wanted to.
Instead of on the wings.
That's right, because on the wings, the fighter jocks had to have their bullets, their tracer, if they converge, it's something like 600 yards away or something. They had it fixed so they'd converge there. And how they ever got those mechanical gun sights to tell you anything, I don't know. I tried to read them. I couldn't read them.
But the 109 could shoot through its propeller without hitting itself.
Right.
So that became more accurate.
A lot of accuracy.
And what number mission was this for you?
10th.
This was the 10th mission.
Now,
okay.
My son had been doing some looking into this thing for me, and he said the record says I had 12 missions. Well, I don't remember, but my record says 12. I know that I flew one mission as spare. No, well, took off as spare and came home.
Okay.
As I was supposed
to. Maybe they counted that one.
And I flew as spare on another engine another time when the guy did drop out, and I flew and went on and flew.
Oh, okay. All right.
I say 10. He said 12.
Okay.
It didn't make a whole lot of difference,
right.
Really.
Now, was this the first time your airplane was being targeted by an enemy fighter on this 10th mission, as we're going to call it? Or had you been shot at before? I mean, obviously, you dealt with flak.
I really don't remember any other attacks.
Okay.
Maybe one or two. I remember one more, but maybe
a quick slashing attack.
Yeah, this one incident I'll tell you about. I did pretty well. I've been flying it, and I was decent, you know, in being able to do what I was supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. So I started flying second element lead in the squadrons. Okay, we had three squadrons of six airplanes.
Right.
Each squadron having three airplanes. Okay, so I was lead in the second element. One day, they want to tell you about, of the upper squadron. Mm-hmm. And I was flying along fat, dumb, and happy because we had a lot of while to go to get to the target. And I was lollygagging, not keeping up in the formation. So they said, hey, bandits, 12 o'clock level. So I poured the coals, that thing, and not to get back into place.
Because what? There was safety in numbers?
Oh, yeah, because the formations were designed to be able to get the most firepower going this way, this way, this way, this way,
up,
and this
down,
way.
Down, forward, back, left,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and they did. The way they were set up, they were always designed. They were pretty smart cookies. We were.
Sure. Someone spent some time studying the optimal response.
Right,
okay.
Yeah. So anyway, this particular time, and I was late, and I was trying to get back up with my group, and I was at fault in that respect, no question about it. Mm-hmm. But this 109 came toward us. I could see it. It wasn't firing, but flew right under my left wing. And I tell you what, I mean, I'd know him today if he had not had his mask on. He was that close under my left wing.
Wow.
Flying. Right on his tail was the most beautiful P-51 you've ever seen in your life, fishtailing, shooting at him, shooting the hell out of him.
And they just happened to come right by you.
I tried to kiss him. He went by. He wouldn't let me.
All right. Well, war is raging all around you. So let's get back to the ME-109 that's got you in his sights now.
Okay.
All right. So he's coming in from what direction?
Straight ahead, 12 o'clock level.
All right.
I could see the tracers going off in his guns.
Okay.
Couldn't move. I couldn't move that fast. I felt a thud in my right wing, and he hit the right engine. One or two, I don't know. He may have hit both of them. I remember when it happened, I did what we're supposed to do. I pulled the power back, and I turned the fire extinguishers on. Mm-hmm. Had one in each of the engines. But we were not doing too bad. I was dropping down out of the formation, and he made another pass at us and came on from underneath this time, more or less a disangle, a quarter of a 45 degree. They shot more, and the bombardier was in the catwalk going from pilot's compartment down to the bombardier's compartment. And he was there, and they hit him in the chest with a 50 caliber. But he got hit. I could feel it, and I saw him, and he saw blood coming out of his mouth. And so I knew he was gone. About that time, or before that, I had rung the bell to bail out. And, of course, I made some intercom connections, too. But people were getting out because the alarm had gone off. And they all got out except him. I was getting out, and the airplane, I hadn't put it on automatic pilot yet after the hits. Mm-hmm. It went up on his right wing because that's where all the thrust was. So I got back in the seat, and everybody got out, and I got the airplane straightened out and put it on automatic pilot. So they would fly. Mm-hmm. You would fly skewed like. Then I jumped out. Hmm. I went out to bombardier's hatch with me and jumped and looked down. And you know what? I had no alternative. None at all. I go down. I'm not going to stay there in the airplane burning. So I got out and looked down there. Lord, help me get through this. Mm. And I did, and went out and tumbled a few times. Then the chute, I pulled the chute. Remember, I had enough awareness. I said, okay, it's about time to pull the ripcord now. And I was thinking that clearly. Don't ask me why or how, but training must have been the answer. Mm-hmm. But I was given that kind of training and had that kind of reaction. And so I pulled the ripcord, and about time for it to open. Look back, and I saw it trailing out behind me. And I don't remember too much after that, but then the chute got caught in a tree, and I was let down. My feet didn't even sting when I hit the ground. That's how comfortable it was.
And where were you at this point?
I was near the Belgian border on the way home. Funnies, I had a lot of funnies happen. And I feel so strongly about this that I must, well, I tell everybody until everybody doesn't want to hear it or blue in the face or something. Did I tell you about waking up and being afraid?
No.
I flew the first mission scared.
Understandably.
Very scared.
Sure.
I flew it on the right side, you know, get me oriented and so forth.
The right side of the?
Right, of the airplane. I was co-pilot.
Okay.
And but I flew it. So they wanted to see if I could handle it.
Sure.
Almost vomited. I was so scared because the flak was coming up. And I could see it and feel it. And so I was very much aware of it. So on the second mission, I was the first pilot. And I got up scared. This is as real as I can ever, as can ever be. I said, Lord, is today the day I get killed? A little prayer. And such a tremendous relief fell over me.
Really?
Now, I'm saying this, and I'll preach it to the high heavens. I don't give a darn. I said, Lord, help me get through this. Now, psychologically, I think it meant that, hey, stupid, you know, you don't have any control, so go ahead and forget it. I think that may be the psychology of it, but I'll have to give the Lord credit for it.
There you go.
Okay? But after that, after being awakened and having that, I was afraid. I was scared, but I wasn't frantic. I don't know what another word would be.
You weren't fearful anymore, maybe?
I wasn't fearful, yes.
Sure.
I knew what happened was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped me get through my flying missions. The same thing when I went out there and fled in a parachute. Mm-hmm. Same thing. And I said, thank you, Lord, for getting me here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean it, really, because this is the way it was. My feet didn't even sting. I had a gentle landing.
But you were all spread out, your crew was, right? So
yeah, all spread out.
Did any of you meet up, or was that impossible?
Three of us, we got together after it happened. We were under control at that point, but three of us were put together. Let me tell you one funny thing. A lot of funny things happened. I was smoking at the time,
okay. And
I had a Zippo lighter,
right. Which
is a rather difficult thing to come by.
Mm.
Because you didn't have those things all over. And he searched me and saw the lighter, and he took it. And I remember looking at him, and I went back, and he gave it back to me.
Well, hold on. We're getting ahead. Who is this? Who's the he?
Okay, I'm sorry. Excuse me. A motorcycle guard, a motorcycle person,
mm-hmm.
appeared at the top of the hill. Got in a tree.
They'd seen you coming down.
Yeah, and I'd already gotten my LMF chute, and I was supposed to be thrown. I threw it this way, and I was supposed to go this way, you
right.
know, like we told. He came over the hill and came down. Now, he had guns on him. He didn't have a gun in his hand. He came right down, and so.
This is a German soldier?
Then he searched me,
And
I gave him the lighter, and this is when he took it and shut up. He didn't talk anymore. I mean, he didn't scream at me anymore.
Okay.
So I knew that and sort of felt that that's what he wanted. But he made me take my parachute and my Mae West, which is a flotation device.
Yes.
And walk, I don't know, quarter of a mile. It went not very far. It's a little town of Nienburg, Germany, which was near Belgium. And we got there. And here again, I think I was in shock, if anything. But we got there to the place, the little village, and the man with the big squirrel gun came out about that long. And he was my guard, and he was told, I can see by motions, that to guard me, the driver of the motorcycle policeman, just screaming his head off at me. I took my Zippo lighter out and gave it to him. He shut up and left.
This was after he had already given it back to you and you put your hand out? Okay. Did you fly with sidearms, like a pistol?
Okay. We started out, yes. No, we had them when I went overseas.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I don't remember when it was. Let's say, I never did carry down a flying mission.
Okay. So they didn't have to de-arm you when they captured you?
The powers that be, saw that it's very difficult for us to try to escape.
Right.
And a gun would just cause us to have more problems.
Mm. Okay.
So I tried to turn my gun in.
So this is May of 1944?
April. April.
And so 9 out of the 10 of you made it, and your...
Correct.
Your mm-hmm. one crew member was dispatched in the airplane before everyone else bailed out. Okay. And so what did they do with you at that point?
We went to this little village, and the guard captured two others, the co-pilot and the radio operator, and put us together, and we start walking to the Army post.
Okay.
Which is the compound, and... it was April the 29th. It was 2 years to the day that I'd gotten my wings with the car running. But a nice, very pretty little German girl with water was coming on her bicycle, coming down the road toward us like this. The radio operator, his name was Ulysses C. Briggs, so we called him Useless. You know, we had a
good an early call sign. Okay.
Yeah. But he did the wolf whistle at her as she was riding by. And I said, "Briggs, shut up. Don't do that." Not a thing happened, but he did. There was a guard with a gun in their back. And
he's still making cat calls, huh? So, all right.
But anyway, we went on to the, the German post where the military was. I was given some bread, which is not very good, and some coffee, which was even worse, and put into a cell which had an inclined wooden bed on it. And that was where I spent the night. This is, now, when I got shot down, it was about 10:30, 11:30 in the morning. So by the time I got there, it was in the afternoon. So I went in, and they didn't interrogate me anything, but went ahead and put me in jail.
Okay.
I could hear airplanes and I was in the area, I thought, on the ground. And I thought, now, if I can escape, I can get in one of those airplanes. Shoot.
Well, a man has to have something to keep his brain stimulated.
Yeah, that's right.
All right.
Okay. So that happens. At that point, food was horrible. This coffee and bread was just, well, it was something in your stomach when I made it.
Right.
I smoked at the time, but I had not had a cigarette for a long time. Got out the, I think being taken to the room, to the cell, I had phlegm in my throat. So I coughed it up and was going to spit it out. And I went over to the side of this walk, this pathway, and my spittle hit on the walkway rather than in the weeds. German guard saw it.
Uh-oh.
And he was on his head. They were doing a gas mask exercise. Started screaming at me through his gas mask, and I knew what he was doing. That was a horrible thing for somebody to do, a spit in Germany.
All right.
So I reached down. I remember cleaning it up with my hand, and he kicked me. He was screaming the whole time at me. And I sort of felt into it. So I felt that's what he wanted, so I cleaned it up. I saw it coming, and I raised my hand, and I think he hit my arm. Didn't hurt me a bit. But anyway, he'd got my attention.
Sure.
And then he took me on to jail and spent the night. Went by train from there to our interrogation center. Now, en route, have you been to Germany?
I have.
Okay, you know how the train stations are. They're huge train stations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we went to one of those. A lot of the windows were out because of bombings and so forth. But we were transferred from one train to another. And the civilians there were about a dozen of them inside over there, just screaming to high heaven when they saw who we were.
Right.
But the guards protected us.
Hmm.
And we were taken on to the Stalag, I forget what they called it, the Luft is air in German.
Right.
And Stalag is camp. So I don't know the name. It was an interrogation center.
All right.
They knew everything about me, names, the crew. In fact, one of them got named my fiancé. They didn't really question me too much because they knew I didn't know anything. And I told them, I met, and that's my crew. The interrogator is the one who asked me. I had that information, and he gave me a cigarette to smoke, and he was a Belgian or something. But a very nice guy, spoke good English, and he asked me about all these things, and I went on. As I said, I knew nothing, and they knew I knew nothing. That was the interesting thing. They even asked me why, we changed our altitude before takeoff. Remember the...
Right, the blackboard with a plus two?
They knew that. They knew that they had been changed. They wanted to know why it had been changed.
So they had an informer on the base?
Yes.
Wow.
Tremendously. Of course, we had spies in their group, too. But
sure.
They knew a whole lot about us.
Hmm.
And they kept my navigator at the interrogation an extra day.
Oh.
Because of this factor. Because he knew more about the things
right.
going than I did.
Yeah.
And I was happy about that. Hell, I didn't want to know anything.
Well, I'm sure you were relieved to see your crew.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was. I don't know who was with me on the train, but we went by train
mm-hmm.
near Breslau, Poland, and got off the train. We were in prison cars with belt with bars in the window.
Mm-hmm.
Got out, and we're standing milling around after getting off the train, and a German guard stood on the loading platform up there. Remember, we were still in stroke, in shock. This was 5 days after I'd gotten shot down, something like six or seven days. And he was standing on the platform, and he had his head mean looking. He had guns bristling all over him, and as mean as they can be. And he says, "Jesus Christ, fellas, where are you guys from?" And he had the most beautiful Brooklynese accent you have ever heard in your life.
Okay.
He was the first thing we had heard. He said, "Rouse met him. Rouse met him. Miss him. Knock now. Make fast."
Uh-huh.
That's all we had heard for 3, 4, 5, 6 days.
Right. And here this guy speaking Brooklyn English.
And we all gathered around him, and he started, my cousin, so they sort of had some relatives. He had gone he lived in the United States, had gone to England for some reason, maybe to visit his parents or something,
uh-huh.
got impressed into the military. That's what he was doing, but he was telling us what was going on. This was the 7th or the 8th day of June of...
1944.
Mm-hmm. The day or after...
D-Day.
D-Day.
Mm-hmm.
Our morale shot up like you've never seen before. Can you imagine here with BOWs, not knowing what was going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
And we were told they've started the invasion. And I tell you what, our morale, they've shot up.
I bet.
We were taken to the Stalag Luft 3. Stalag is prison, Luft is air, and the number 3. This was the camp near Breslau, Poland. Breslau was, the Poland, the border was just very close to our end of our camp. That's how far we were. Now, the compound, and this is my calculations just from memory about how large it was about 500 plus acres. Now, I'm guessing at that because I don't know. Each of the compounds held 2,000 people. We had barracks. Like Hogan's Heroes. Just exactly like ours, yeah.
Huh.
And you see the relationship they had? We had not as good a relationship with the guards, but pretty good.
Hmm.
It didn't have any positive bad treatment at all.
No torture?
No. We were officers, and the Geneva Convention prohibited that.
Right.
We were held there for a long period of time. As officers, we had to do nothing. All we had to do is survive. The Germans gave us half of a Red Cross parcel a week. We were supposed to get a whole one. Well, grow hungry all the time.
Mm.
They fed us one time a week. Their bread was this horrible German bread. It was terrible. But they fed us whatever they had.
Sure.
And they fed it. You know, there's a big thing. It looks like a turnip, about that big. Has a name for it. Purple on top and around.
Mm.
And they would give us, when they had been grown, they would give us, that was our meal for the day, or sometimes various kinds of things. They were not bad, not very much of it, though. I went down about 155 pounds while I was there because I would be all the time.
Hmm.
We had a lot of talent among those guys in there. Remember who we were.
Mm-hmm.
We were guys who were 20, 21, 22, 23 years old, sort of in the prime of our
youth.
Growing up in activity.
Right.
Had good musicians, good people who in college. I had one semester of college. You know, we had a good bunch of people, a good, highly, pretty well-educated people.
Mm-hmm.
We had one man, or several, who wrote a parody on our being there. Mm-hmm. Now, keep in mind, we were Stalag, we were BOWs, we were Kriegies. Krieg is Kriegsgefangenen. Krieg is war. Gefangenen is prisoner.
Okay.
We were Kriegsgefangenen. K-R-E-I-G-S. You got to spell the rest of it. I can't. But we called ourselves Kriegies. It was our nickname. I have to give you the background of these things. Again, the quality of the aptitude that our people have is fabulous. We wrote this song about our prison camp. And it was based on, see if you can remember, if you can identify the melody, which I hope I can do. Don't know why there's no sugar in my pie. Creaky rations. My appetite has overcome my passions. I'm hungry all the time. Table's bare. There's no food there anywhere. It's starvation. My soul has reached the depth of degradation. I'm hungry all the time. I dream of ham and eggs and then wake up all this bad aseptic something. And all my coffee is off. My call is nothing. That bread is nothing. It's except the arcane words. Hungry as I am. Soon diabetic. That's when I blow my top. Can't go on. And then I said, never did. Can't go on.
You still remember that pretty well? Yeah. 75 years later.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
That was stormy weather.
Stormy weather.
So you took that. Right. And it said so much in such a little time.
Sure. Well, you need a way to process the experience you're in. You're confined, but you're not horribly maltreated.
That's exactly right.
But whatever the issue is, in this case, lack of food, that becomes what you focus on.
Okay. Food was our number one subject mm-hmm. of conversation.
Right.
We smoked. Remember, we were 20 to 30-year-old
guys. So I'm guessing we're talking about girls, too.
But we didn't even talk about girls. We talked about food. Now, this is true. This is true. Food was our first number one issue of thoughts.
Okay.
But I have to point out that we had a lot of talent. And it can keep the era, the band, if you will, of people we had. I'm trying not to brag here, but everybody in there had to be in the upper level of our country in terms of physical ability mm-hmm. and reasoning ability and maturity and
sure.
things of this sort. We all had to be up there. We had a 14-piece band.
Who provided the instruments?
The YWCA provided instruments, and we had professionals
wow.
playing, doing music for us. Had concerts, and the mm-hmm. Germans came, and they loved it, and everybody had a good time.
You know, Mr. Hicks, my father, who recently passed away, was a foot soldier in World War II. He carried his trumpet everywhere he went. He was a combat engineer, and he fought in the Battle of the Bulge, and he liberated a prisoner of war camp, not yours. But he, at the end of the war, had a band as well with Hank Mancini. And they played in the south of France for a long time. Yeah, yeah. He tried to get Hank to write music, and apparently he didn't want to do it. And finally he came back, and of course we all know that he wrote Pink Panther and a bunch of others. But it's interesting to hear you talk about music, because when I think of World War II, particularly with my father, who we buried just a few Fridays ago, that was a big subject of the conversation. Was he carried his trumpet everywhere he went and always put together a band. So it sounds like you did as well.
How old was your father when he died?
Not quite 94.
I'm 94.
He was born in 25.
Well, he was a kid when he was over there.
Oh, he went and he turned 18 in 1943.
Yeah. Now, think of the hell he went through.
Oh, he never spoke of it.
You know, now he had a hard time. This is, I feel almost guilty that I didn't have any of that. Mm. I know it's not right to feel guilty because I had no control, but I feel, I'm trying to say respectful because I did not go through that crap.
Well, but you spent almost a year or more than a year in captivity.
11 months.
11 months.
Yeah. But the thing is, I didn't go through the crap that he went through, the hell because he had either buck private or something when he
ended up a tech sergeant.
Okay, well, he may have gotten a little bit better treatment, but our sergeants that owned my airplane had to work on the farms.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in the captivity?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
See, we didn't have to turn a hand over. Wow. We had to take care of ourselves.
But they made them forced labor?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Poor guards, they were just almost as bad off as we were in terms of. I've got a lot of funnies. I can talk for 3 hours.
I don't know how long the listener wants to stay tuned, but I'm sure they love your stories. Buchenwald is the camp he liberated just finally.
Oh, man,
that wasn't a prisoner of war camp. That was a SS.
For the Jews.
Yeah. It affected him the rest of his life. What was your liberation like?
Absolutely wonderful. Okay. We spent our time there in December of 44. We could hear the Russian guns coming in. Mm. The Battle of Bulge was going on in December, if you recall.
Yes.
And we knew nothing about it, really, other than that. We went to Nuremberg. We spent a short time there. Then had to walk about 100 kilometers from Nuremberg to Moosburg, Germany.
When was this? What time?
This was April 45.
Sure.
Yeah. We'd learned enough German to communicate with the people. If you had a D bar, which was a high protein chocolate bar and cigarettes, you could buy the moon.
You could barter for other things.
We had those things.
Like gold bars.
And so we used them as such, too.
Mm-hmm.
I heard, and that I have no bearing, that one guy got disease on the march, but I don't know if that's true or not. I mean,
a certain type of disease?
Yeah.
Because he had cigarettes and chocolate.
Exactly. No question about it. But we traded some cigarettes for this cart, a two-wheeled cart that the people used to move their goods from home, from the,
sure.
the garden up. And we were four of us together, and they put our gear into that cart, and we did 100 miles pushing that cart. Here's a piece of cake. 10 miles a day, but a piece of cake.
Oh, gosh.
I must tell you about the release. April the 29th, which was my graduation anniversary.
3 years earlier.
Uh-huh. We heard noises as Sunday. It was on a Sunday. Heard the sounds of guns and so forth. And then we saw a tank coming over the top of the hill. And it was Patton's tank.
Hmm.
And he was in the first or the second tank. I don't know which one.
Patton himself?
Patton himself.
Wow.
And then in the tank, ran through the, broke the gates down.
Sure.
And we all got, well, I still do it. I cried.
Yeah.
Flag went up. I cried. I wasn't mistreated at all, but I was free now.
Yeah.
But he came in tall, had on with, he had two or three stars, but he had enough of them.
Mm-hmm.
He had a pair of guns in his fist.
Yep.
Walked around. And I tell people this, and I'm lying, so make sure that everybody knows. I was walking beside him, and I tried to kiss him. He wouldn't let me. I'm lying. Like, but I'm walking.
But you wanted to, right?
Yeah, I did.
Oh,
and I was walking this close to him.
Wow.
I was running, and he was striding. You know, he was a tall man.
Mm.
And he went and inspected the camp, and he finished up and said, man, you've done a good job here. He had a high-pitched voice, but Lord, he was wonderful.
Oh, well,
we were held there.
Salvation, right?
That was my release from prison camp.
Wow. All right, so they shipped you back. I want to know, did you ever fly the B-17 again?
No, not the 17, no.
No, okay.
No, I flew a little bit. After that, I flew AT-10s. And,
well, you made a career in the became the Air Force, right?
I got out of a prison camp, got married, went to and got on active duty. I flew a little bit, but I was putting on a desk job, which I hated. Remember, I was unlearned. Really, all I knew was flying airplanes.
Uh-huh.
I didn't like my desk job. My wife got pregnant, so we decided we'd get out and go back home to Louisville, Kentucky.
All right.
Which we did. And then I got dismissed from the, but I stayed in reserves.
And rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel.
That's exactly right.
All right.
They'll go all a little bit of it, yeah.
Okay.
So we got back, and we had three children, and I started college. And I tell you, I had to work and go to college. It was rough. Didn't have any money. Well, And my pay is, rose to captain then.
Uh-huh.
And my pay was $400 a month. No flying pay, not at that point. Mm-hmm. See, I think flying pay was 50% more. So as a major, I was a captain there until I got recalled. I wasn't in a flying, nor would they put me back on flying pay, flying work.
Okay.
And flight status. And so I finished there and then applied for ROTC. And I got a job teaching at the University of Kentucky.
Oh, so you were a professor?
Yes, assistant professor of air science.
All right.
Big deal. But I was in the presence of angels or of kings.
Okay.
Hey, have you heard of RUPP?
RUPP.
RUPP, R-U-P-P.
In what context?
And he was the basketball coach for University of Kentucky.
Okay. No, I don't believe I have.
Mean as a snake. But Kentucky was the national champion for 3 or 4 years.
Okay.
And back in, this was in 46, 48, something like
okay.
that.
A couple of years after the war.
RUPP, and who was the football player who went to, who was from Alabama. He was so mean. I look back, and I think the world of football has ruined the colleges in this respect. I has damaged the colleges because those guys in the basketball first, as the in the ROTC, we had rule was on that you were, this was when the draft was on, in place, but you were exempt from the draft if you were in college.
Uh-huh.
RUPP and this other coach got the best men they got in that came in, and they went to those two, football or basketball, and therefore got scholarships, but they had to be in the military, so they, all of them, they were in ROTC.
Okay.
Some Army, some Air Force.
Sure. Did you ever find out who the pilot was who shot you down?
Never did, no.
No information no. about that? And what happened with you and your crew after your entrapment? Actually, I don't want to call it entrapment. What would I call it? Imprisonment.
Yeah.
Have you kept in touch? Did you keep in touch through later life?
To a degree, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, with the co-pilot and navigator, very close contact, because the navigator was from Nashville, and the co-pilot was from New York, and so we did get together and communicate. The co-pilot was a musician as well, and one of the guys in our room with us was a hot, red, hot guitar player, and so the two of them played music in POW camp, or for everybody else. We had an orchestra, a 14-piece orchestra. And it was good.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we did keep in touch. When in the navigator, we sort of lost touch, and he died. He died early.
Okay.
We all smoked. He had been enlisted in the Army, and he went to cook and baker school.
Hmm.
So when he came into our group, he became the chef of our room. He took it, he said, under one condition, this condition, I want every bit, every morsel of food that comes in this room, every morsel.
So he can turn it into something?
No, yeah, so he could turn it in. And also he had one assistant who was a navigator on and later on in B-52s or something. But anyway, he had a navigator with him. He was a young kid, and he was his assistant. The rest of us did all the other work in the kitchen. But he's the one who cooked.
Okay.
And he,
it made it less painful.
we had D-bars, which is a candy thing I told you about.
Yep.
And he would take a D-bar and shave it up and make a cake with the ground up bread and the little tiny bit of sugar we had and make a cake. We had a cake every day. But
you did okay.
Morale, sky high. But even though, Gene, the co-pilot, and we had another fellow musician in the room. We were together quite a bit afterwards. They did a bit of music, and they played, and we would go and listen to them play guitar, both of them played guitars.
Okay.
Gene was more of classical, and Chuck was a red-hot. Red-hot. Anyway, go ahead.
So you kept in touch after.
Yeah, with all the other roommates. We kept in touch with roommates, and they finally died off here and there. And my crew died off. Well, that's my crew died about a year ago, something like that.
Okay.
I'm the old guy.
Have you
in the years since gone back to Germany or Poland?
No, I've not gone back to Poland. We have, my wife and I went to Berlin, saw the wall.
Okay.
And we're very much impressed with that. Germany is still a beautiful place.
Mm-hmm.
The Danube River is the sanitation source for Europe.
So everything flows into the Danube and then out into wherever it goes?
And we went to a place down there in southern Germany, near Salzburg, and saw the Danube. And I went on a bridge going over the Danube, brown, because of the cesspool thing. Mm. They had blocked off a part of the river, we'll say 100 yards wide and 500 yards long on the bank on the from the edge of the water, and blocked that off and had purified the water. And we could sit there on the bridge looking down, saw all the brown river, but that blue spot that they had done that to.
Okay.
That's an aside, but it still, to me, speaks volume about what they went, because the Danube was the sewer for Europe.
So when you went back, did you feel any sort of animosity for the war?
Not at all. I'm sorry to digress so much. On our march, we marched all the night, all night long the first night, and we had not had any sleep for 12 hours, so we were dead tired.
Mm-hmm.
So we had rest stops periodically, and we could just lie on the snow and sleep. That's all we did. One night, and then that night, about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, this is so important to me. A lady came out of her house. Now, we were the prisoners, and she was free. She came out of the house with a pitcher of hot water and poured hot water into our cups, gave us some hot water. It was like nectar. Now, I have never forgotten that. This was a German lady, and we were POWs. We had another instance on the same walk, my march. I went to a house. We were allowed to sort of branch out and go and do too far, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to the house and knocked the door and asked her for some food. And she gave me some soup, which was potatoes and water, and there was not much else. But she had a big stove in a corner like they had in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I turned the radio on, and BBC came on.
Ah.
And she said, hold it down. So I was listening to BBC on her radio, and she was let me do it. Now, I'm saying that because that reflects the German people.
Right.
Now, they really treated us beautifully. Those, in that sense, the guards were very decent to us. We did not have a hard time. They had the job they had to do. And we enjoyed them.
Well, and they were doing their duty, arguably.
Yeah. Hogan's Heroes physical camp was modeled after our camp.
Okay.
So
no kidding.
Same, almost identical to it.
Well, speaking of Hollywood, I assume you've seen or at least heard of the movie Memphis Belle.
Oh, yes.
But
yes.
Several years out. I wondered if you could comment on, having watched that and having lived that, where the movie was right and maybe where it was wrong. I mean, because that's what most people will build their interpretations of, both the air war in the early parts of the war, as well as the B-17.
Okay. Now, the 17, yes, I went in it. And, of course, when I get into 17 now, the only place I want to go is up in the cockpit. I don't think I ever the rest of the airplane. All I do is the cockpit, right. And of course, they can't get up there anymore. So it refurbished in Memphis. When I was, and it was in Memphis at the time.
The actual Memphis Belle.
Yeah, the Memphis Belle, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I read the book Memphis Belle, and trying to answer your question as best I can, that last mission Memphis Belle was on in the book was incorporated just about all the things that happened to me in my 10 missions. We had somebody get killed. They had somebody badly wounded. We had the bomb bay doors open. I remember looking down the bomb bays and seeing the nothing down there. And said bombardier got killed. We had good camaraderie among the members up there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a boss, and I didn't have to worry a bit about being boss. It was, hey, we're here, and we do the job.
Right.
But I'm saying in the last day was used in incorporating things that happened. They have it holes We had a hole in the airplane every mission we were on.
Right.
I'm trying to get to describe what you're referring to. On one mission, we were, you know, the Zuider Zee in Holland. At that point, was a miniature, oh, it was an ocean, a big lake, saltwater mm-hmm. lake. Mm-hmm. But it had, so in the Dutch people are the world's best in hydraulic engineering. But there's a lake there, the Zuider Zee, and we would let down on the way home going over that lake because we were out of the reach of the people of the Germans. Mm-hmm. And we let down this one day, six of us. They shot one round of 88 millimeter guns at us from that lake. They had boats stationed out there.
Because they knew you were flying over it?
Yep. They knocked two of the airplanes down. Huh. They knocked a hole in the rear fuselage that you could crawl through.
Oof.
They cut the electrical system. It had to fly manually, which was all right. We had a hole in the airplane every mission we were on.
But you never flew the B-17 again?
Never handled it, huh. Never handled it.
No kidding.
Because they were just not around.
Right.
And the ones who had it were old pilots, and they didn't want any young whippersnapper, you know.
Right.
But never flew it. I've flown in them a couple of times. And flying out in the back is not fun. It's not even fun.
Right.
Unless you can drive it.
No, I agree. Well, we're both pilots, so we're of course going to feel that way. Well, Mr. Hicks, this has been a lot of fun. I've really enjoyed your stories and learning a little bit about the war and the B-17. Thank you so much. We on this show have a tradition of talking about our nicknames or call signs. Now, you said you had a crewman whose name was Useless. Did you have a nickname or what we would call a call sign these days?
Yep.
Okay. Do you care to share what it was and how it came about?
I have a size 13 shoe. When we were training at Dalhart in Dalhart, Texas, in the wintertime, I got two stories to tell you there. First of all, in the wintertime, and on Christmas Day of 43, I had to fly something down to San Antonio. Mm-hmm. We flew from Dalhart. The airplane, the 17, has a 17-foot tail. The runways were up to my waist.
In the snow?
The snow.
Okay.
The runways being so high, we're at Labrador. That's when we were 17 feet high.
Okay. Yeah.
We took off that day and flew all day long doing practice work and planned landing and so forth down to San Antonio, picked up something. I got out in this blizzard weather, the cold weather, and got down there and took my jacket off, all in the same state, the same day. The weather was that different. To me, it's more important that it happened.
Mm-hmm.
But while at Dalhart, I had to get some overshoes to get out in the snow. They didn't have any of my size, so they gave me size 14 shoes, overshoes.
All right.
And my navigator promptly notified me that my name was Shuffle. So I would shuffle around all the time. So I was called Shuffle the whole time.
You were Shuffle, all right, because of shoes. Oh, that's crazy. All right. Well, Mr. Hicks, this has been really enjoyable. You are a treasure trove of information. And
don't forget, I lie a lot.
Well, we like to say never let the truth get in the way of a good story. And if my math is correct, let's see, you said 1921 and then you said February. So you've turned 98 years young this year, is that
98
right?
And a half.
Well, God bless you, sir.
I'm blessed.
You are indeed.
Shoot, I tell you what. And, you know, the good thing, I do appreciate it. I do appreciate all the things that the Lord's done for me to help and or keep me out of trouble and things that if I've done wrong that I should have been punished for, you know, these kinds of things.
Yeah.
But really, I mean it. I'm just overwhelmed with that.
Well, that's a great way to end. Thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you for your time. Now, you are retired.
I did, yes.
How many hours did you have in?
In military aircraft, a little over 3,800.
Gee, my nettle. And you're flying fighters.
Some of those were under an hour at a time, yes.
Good night. Okay. I always wanted to make a carrier landing. I always felt like I didn't have any qualms about the idea. But when you hit the landing, you stop, don't you?
It's a controlled crash.
Yeah. I've heard this so many times.
Yeah, that's right.
Hey, you know, my fear, and okay, I'll stop here. My fear was I didn't want to go in the Navy, although I love the Navy and what I saw of it, and of course the uniform was outstanding, all these kinds of things.
Thank you.
I was thinking, here I am, I'm flying. I was before I even got in the Army. Mm-hmm. I'm flying an airplane. I'm a dogfight over the water. And
you're imagining this?
I'm trying to get home to the carrier, but no radio and no lights on. Uh-huh. And I decided, really, that made me, I ain't going to the Navy. Because of that. All those facts right there.
There you go.
And so you've been there and done that too, haven't you?
Well, not with the no radio and no lights, but our systems these days are pretty reliable.
Yeah.
Great. All right. Well, thanks very much.
You've been listening to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, brought to you by BVR Productions. Got a question for the show? Send an email to questions@fighterpilotpodcast.com or leave a message on our listener line at 877-MACH-101. That's 877-622-4101. Be sure to check out our website at fighterpilotpodcast.com. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. For exclusive Fighter Pilot Podcast content, check out our Patreon page. Please like, follow, and subscribe to the show. And don't forget to share us with your network. Thank you for listening.
The views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of the host and our guests and do not represent the position of the Department of Defense or its components.
Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.